Welcome to The Lowdown, KMXT's new daily show dedicated to giving you the up-to-date information we have available on the COVID-19 outbreak and how it's impacting life on Kodiak Island. The Lowdown will focus on the facts as provided to us by local and state officials. During the show, we give you access to local officials and experts on COVID-19 and community actions related to it. If you have questions for our guests, please email them to lowdown@kmxt.org or call KMXT at 486-3181. You can find a list of upcoming guests on our Facebook page or on our website, kmxt.org. Audio from each day's program will be posted on the website. To the sad, sad truth, the dirty lowdown.
Thanks for tuning into the medical edition of The Lowdown. A lot going on, a lot of issues to address. So we're going to dive right into things here. We got some questions already submitted by listeners. What's up, Pam? Well, we've got technical issues here. If you would like to address the docs, and this is a medical Doc of the Rock show, shoot us an email or call 486-3181. We'll try and get your questions answered. Today we have Dr. Evan Jones from Canada in the studio, Dr. Steve Smith from Providence, Elsa DeHart from Public Health, and Dr. Curtis Mortensen again from Kodiak Community Health Center. I'm going to start out today like we actually originally started out 11 weeks or so ago with the governor's announcement last night that we've done such a great job that things are going to open up. The virus is still with us. We must function with it now and manage it, but as of Friday, Alaska is open for business. All businesses can open, all houses of worship, libraries, museums, all recreational activities, all sports activities. It is the responsibility of individuals, businesses, and organizations to minimize the spread of COVID-19. We encourage all to follow local, state, national, and industry guidelines on ways to conduct business and activities safely. There are some exceptions. The 14-day quarantine for interstate and international travel to Alaska remains in place. It'll be reevaluated June 2nd. All senior centers, prisons, institutions will continue to have restricted access. Large gatherings need approval from local public health before scheduling. The communities may still keep in place travel restrictions, and some Alaskan community may wish to extend restrictions on non-essential travel into their communities for health reasons. Check with your local community first. And the health mandates, 15 elective medical and dental are still in place. 17 in regards to commercial fishing are still in place. And it says 18 in regards to interstate travel remain in effect. But I had thought that had been eliminated the other day. Mm-hmm. The governor suggested it's because of you that in Alaska our numbers are low, and we'll try and keep our numbers low. And that another mandate is due to come out, I believe, today or tomorrow. That's supposed to codify this plan. That said, the local governments, from my understanding, are meeting. This came as kind of a shock as normal. And the local governments are still trying to respond. So our ESC is still trying to get together, and we're going to try and bring them on the air as soon as we can. So either listen to KMXT News, follow what's on the state's website, or listen to a Lowdown tomorrow or on Friday, and we'll try and have that ESC group in to try and tell you what the local plan is, because the governor has left this open to local municipalities for trying to set the rules for this a little bit, to make it a little slower maybe. Who knows what's going to happen? We'll probably know more by Friday. So thank you all for being here today. It's pretty busy day.
Yes.
Let's just start. What's your reaction to what's happened?
I keep emphasizing that the state eventually does need to open because people have to get back to work. It's easy for people who are taking a paycheck to say, you guys need to stay, you know, stay away from others. But I get it that they have done it. If you look at the graphs of new infections, Alaska has done a nice job. And it may not be everything that people are doing, just that Alaskans naturally tend to spread out and a little more independent. We have more room to roam here. And density seems to be a big part of spreading this disease.
I mean, I think that one thing that I think that it seems like a pretty aggressive opening to me. But one thing that I guess even as we try and open these things up, I think there are certain things that don't go out of style, which is, you know, good hand hygiene, you know, wearing masks, trying to prevent that exposure, still trying to social distance as much as you can. And then I do think that, and I think Elsa would probably agree with this, like the way to manage this is going to be in the future, if somebody does get this, to be able to contact trace. And so if you're in close contact with somebody, which means for 10 minutes, you're within 6 feet of them, I believe that's the kind of the guideline you guys go off of, you should be able to know how many people you had that type of contact with for the past several days. Because if you ended up getting COVID-19, that's what our public health nurses, our contact tracers are going to be asking you. So if you don't know, if you are around so many people that you couldn't tell me that, then that's problematic, because then we can't trace back and kind of nip these hot spots as they go. You know, we've talked a lot about this dance, right? And so part of this dance is, hey, we're opening things up, but what we don't want is just, it's just a free for all. And then we end up with this massive explosion of cases.
Yeah, I agree with Curtis. You know, what he's saying is that it really is a balance between what we're, you know, wanting to open up. We know our businesses need to work, but keeping people safe, it's going to be a challenge for a while.
I have been seeing more and more on the internet about people making fun of the wearing masks, that it doesn't do anything, and that in order to block virus, you'd have to be wearing even more than an N95. That's the fact that even an N95 won't protect you from virus, there's truth to that, but that's not the goal. The goal is to keep spreading it to other people. Just like you'd cover your mouth if you sneezed or coughed, this is a way of being more protective of covering your mouth. Is it protecting you? No, it's not protecting you. It's protecting the people around you. And so I think people need to understand why you're wearing a mask. It's not for yourself. It's to help those around you, just in case you get infected and don't even realize it. And there are, you know, Curtis and I were talking about an article that came out, and maybe you can share that one from, it's a choir in Mount Vernon, Washington.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there was a study that came out. It was by the CDC. And this came out on May 12th, but the events actually occurred in early March, and it was a choir practice. It was a 2.5-hour choir practice that occurred in Washington State. And 87% of the people in that choir, there was one person that had symptoms going into the choir practice, and 87% of those individuals ended up with COVID-19. And so just being aware that certain things, certain settings, and this might have been a perfect storm, maybe that person had an exceptionally high viral load right at that moment in time when they were in this choir practice, but you know, being in really close proximity to each other is a big deal. Singing is probably or if you're a fan of a sport, like one of the reasons for, you know, if you're cheering for your sports team and you're in the close proximity, these are situations where there can be massive infection transfer. And so just being aware that just because we've had very little cases in Alaska compared to other people doesn't mean it couldn't spread very, very quickly. So still taking those precautions.
And it's also interesting because there's been lots of yoga. We talked about this earlier. There's yoga studios that have the same density as Zumba classes, and they have found multiple transmissions in Zumba classes, but no transmissions in the yoga classes with very identical circumstances. So the loudness of it, how loud people are even talking, makes a difference how far you're going to expel the matter from your mouth so that other people get infected. And we are finding that, you know, the reason we're talking about masks is the droplet form of this is an important part of the transmission of it, that it's not, touching and cleaning your hands is still extremely important, but droplets is a huge part of this. Probably it's much bigger than I would have expected. I would have thought touching would have been the biggest transmitter, but we're not sure that it is anymore.
What are you saying as a recommendation to people, to just an individuals and to businesses, when they're now the responsibility for making decisions about what you're going to do is before you? You know, what do you do?
I mean, I think that is as much as businesses can trying to, and I know that I've talked to a lot of business owners trying to do things, you know, in a restaurant, for example, like where you are able to kind of space tables out a little bit more. I think that that's wise. I think that making hand hygiene products available, really readily available for your patrons and for your staff, so that you make sure you're doing that number. I think that the masks, having both people that are working in the restaurant and also, you know, as much as possible patrons be able to wear masks. These are all things that I think that even with the opening, I think that should be, you know, should be adhered to and tried to prevent, you know, some sort of an outbreak of infection.
Yeah, this opening is really putting a lot of the onus on to the individuals and to our communities. You know, the state's pretty much allowing communities and people to do the things they think they need to do. And the efforts we've been making in these last couple of months have really paid off. And so, you know, people need to keep thinking about those things.
Well, my understanding of this was going to be a phased program that was going to take place over time so we could analyze how things were going to happen. And then a week or 2 weeks after something was opened, then we were going to gradually move into the next thing. Now it seems like the floodgates are open, because all of those protections that were put in place, where locally you had to submit a mitigation plan, you put the check mark on the outside of your business, you put hand washing protocols into place, those appear now to be all completely eliminated.
Well, I think it is going to be community by community. So we'll have to see what our ESC decides for Kodiak, what kinds of things we're going to keep in place in town. And it does fall on people to know. And just like Curtis said, you know, you need to know who you're talking to and pay attention if you're going to be out and about.
So for contact tracing purposes, is there no longer a requirement then you keep a log, or do you need to keep a log of who you're seeing if you're in a large group?
So it would be really nice if people could keep a log. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen it, even some people talking about keeping a calendar, who you talk to, who you're with, because when the contact tracing, we have to go back and we need to know everybody you've talked to, you know, very closely, you know, as Curtis was saying, within 6 feet for longer, you know, for 10 to 15 minutes, you know, as we're going through this, all those people we need to contact, and then we need to contact, you know, make that circle. And then if those people get infected, it keeps going out. And so in the beginning of this, when we looked at our cases, we would have 20 contacts we'd be having to follow and figure out, you know, but as we hunkered down, you know, it became easier on our part because we may only have two people. You'd have a household people that you talk to, maybe a coworker. You know, it was very small circles that we had that people were having that much contact with. But of course, that's going to really change. The state is looking at having 500 contact tracers in place in the next couple months, anticipating that possible need.
So not to be too pessimistic on this, but I work in an environment in the emergency room where a lot of our interactions in the not emergent medical conditions have to do with hold my beer and watch this. And that's my big concern is I think we all need to exercise common sense and caution, but somehow when mind-altering substances are involved, we forget those things. And so Elsa's job of contact is going to just how do you figure out who was around the campfire or downtown in the bar if you were cheering for your sports team or intoxicated and singing with a bunch of friends. So I think we're those common sense things of wearing a mask, trying to protect other people, may be problematic. And so I think we've got the snowball sitting at the top of the hill and it's going to roll.
So are we still at the same base point where you're saying for the majority of the population, just use common sense, but for the at-risk portion of the population, stay hunkered down?
That's what I would tell people. I mean, if you have a medical condition that puts you at a higher risk, if you're older, then you should still keep your social distancing and try and limit your contacts.
Should the question we got is, should people continue to stay within their own bubble? As Dr. Zink, I think the other day said, expand your bubble a little bit. So now we're hearing that from the chief medical officer of the state, and now we have an opening order. How do you read the two things together?
I mean, I think that it is a little bit of a they're a little bit separate, but I think that the idea of you know, the governor's you know, announcement yesterday is pretty broad sweeping and seems to kind of open things up for, you know, sort of fair game. What I'm really like, I think that the truth is probably somewhere in between, right? So I'm glad we're not having, although it's you know, disorienting to me, I'm glad we don't have Crab Fest this weekend, right? That would be like the worst case scenario for, you know, an opening like this coming, and then you have this huge community gathering that, you know, where everybody kind of is in close proximity and that type of thing. And I'm not saying I'm glad we're not having Crab Fest, but I think that for this purpose, I think that's a good thing. It doesn't make any common sense to do something like that at this point in time. And I think that we do, you know, I don't think like some sort of massive gathering at this point is a really good idea. However, I think that kind of idea of slowly opening things up, expanding your bubbles. But I do think we would just call on people, and what I would tell my patients is just have a, you know, common sense. Like, this is still a threat. It's not like the threat is totally gone. We just think that we have more infrastructure in place to handle if there would be an outbreak. We have more testing available. There's a lot of things that are in place that weren't in place a few months ago, which is great. But if people don't heed some of the advice of keeping some distance and doing some of these practical measures to help, you know, not create a big outbreak, then, you know, if you're not doing that, then we're kind of setting ourselves up for failure.
Elsa, it seems to imply that for these large group things, that your office is going to be involved in allowing people to do things. You know, if there was going to be a concert or a large gathering somewhere, that there has to be some interaction between you and them, then you have to give them the approval before they could do that.
Well, that's true to a point, and that's why we, you know, people talk with our, like, emergency services council. In Kodiak, that would be up to them. They would talk to public health, they would talk to the providers, they would see what they think would be the best for the community, and then they're the ones who would really make the decision here, and especially here.
Okay, a question from a listener wants to know, doesn't this seem to be a bad time locally to be lifting restrictions given that so many seasonal workers are about to come to town?
And I think it's great that you're going to bring the ESC in here in the next couple of days, because I would love to be a fly on the wall today and hear, you know, how they're going to work with this, because it was I don't think anybody was really prepared for the announcement that Governor Dunleavy made last night. And so now we need to figure out where Kodiak fits in that, you know, and how we can do things safely here. Every community does still have that option to make their own decisions.
Okay. Well, I'm going to take a couple of questions here that, so that we can get them out of the way. There's a question in regards to masks. When I get to home from the store, I throw my mask in the dryer on high for 60 minutes. Does that sanitize it, or do I need to wash it in soap and water first?
I think just drying it is very sufficient. Obviously, if it was soiled, a lot of secretions, it would be a good idea to wash it soap and water first and then dry it. But just for general use, putting it in the dryer is fine. I think there's some recommendations on you can do it in the microwave or in the oven, but I'm not totally familiar with those. You guys?
Once it's heated up, I think the dry, even 15 minutes in the dryer, as long, you know, as long as there's not a bunch of wet clothes in there, is sufficient. That's what's been recommended is 10 to 15 minutes at 160 or 170 degrees is sufficient for doing N95 masks. Cloth masks probably need a little bit more, so I would probably up it to 20 minutes. And so I think it's totally adequate.
Okay. If an older person has COVID-19 and doesn't want to be on a ventilator because of potentially devastating aftermath of ventilation, is Kodiak set up to provide non-invasive respiratory care?
I can take that. So we do have the availability to do what he's referring to there is positive pressure ventilation. And so this is kind of like what you would do like for people with sleep apnea, like a CPAP device or, you know, a BiPAP, which means it's a mask that goes on the face, kind of creates some sort of a suction, and you're able to sort of press, breath support into that patient. We do have the capability of doing that in Kodiak, and we actually have filters on our devices, so we are able to safely do that, even a COVID patient, without, you know, putting a lot of risk to staff. I think that the discussions on, I think the bigger point actually to discuss off this is that for our older patients and even, you know, maybe not as old, I'm looking at Steve over here, I think it's worthwhile having discussions. if one thing that comes out of this pandemic is that people start having discussions about what their advanced directives are and what they would want to have happen at, you know, sort of in a situation like that, I think that would be a really positive thing, because it's one thing that I feel like, you know, every other patient I try and talk to in almost every other patient I talk to in clinic, I'm trying to talk to about those things. But, you know, the amount of input back to me is pretty low versus I think in a time like this, sometimes people take that more seriously. And so I think that either talking to your provider or talking to your family members about what you would want in those situations is a really good thing.
As a follow-up to that, will the person be able to get pain and symptom management for home or get palliative care and hospice care at home, hospital, or another place here in Kodiak?
I think Kodiak is very driven on patient, what the patient wants. I have patients who want to die in their own home of any cause, regardless of coronavirus, COVID-19, and we try to honor the patient's wishes as best as we can, and try to keep people as comfortable as possible as best we can. I know both clinics end up doing a lot of house visits for reasons like that. I've personally done a lot of palliative care for patients who are at end of life. It's part of what we provide as physicians in this community. That's somewhat unique. A lot of communities would not go into the home. A lot of docs wouldn't go into the home. A lot of us do. I do multiple house calls every week. And I think we're very patient-driven because these are our friends and neighbors, and we want to be there for them.
I think another thing I'd add, and I just had this experience of being involved in a lot of kind of end-of-life visits here in recent weeks, but one thing that is a little tricky during this time, and one thing that I think that patients are more likely to choose to go home as well, or try and make it work at home, is that we are limiting the amount of visitors in the hospital right now. Even at end of life, we're not taking as many patients or any family members into the hospital. So I think that makes it even more critical for us to try and provide that outpatient support to help families and support them if that's indeed what they would like to do, and or I should say if that was the patient's wishes too.
We have a question here about COVID and infants. Is there research that you're aware of about how COVID would affect infants?
Still developing at this point. At first, we thought young kids were not affected at all, but we are seeing some kids that are fairly affected. I would say that influenza A is much more dangerous to kids and infants than the COVID-19 disease. We still don't completely know at this point. There's a period, we're learning as we go along. There's a period where we said pregnant women were pretty much unaffected. Then we said, oh no, well actually they are affected here and we are seeing it. Now we're to the I'm not sure stage on pregnant women. We discussed a couple weeks ago that in New York City they checked every woman coming in to deliver a baby, which was about 220 people during the study's time. 31 of them tested positive for coronavirus, and I think it was like 27 of them had no symptoms, despite having testing positive for coronavirus. So we're still not entirely sure. Kids seem to do fairly well with this disease, though. They seem to handle it quite well. Early on, I was preaching, you know, if you have asthma, be careful. Asthma does not seem to be a big factor. It doesn't seem to affect disease outcome with this disease. So we're still learning as we go along.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's so much we don't know. There's been some new reports in recent weeks about this Kawasaki-like disease in kids that's kind of multi-system organ system failure in some kids. I think that there's going to be a lot more that comes out on that. We just don't know a lot. We definitely do know that in general, people that are older and people that have multiple chronic diseases are more susceptible. And that hasn't changed. We've kind of known that for a long time, but the nuances of like kind of the other things is more challenging to decipher right now because we're just learning so much more.
Well, it does seem like that there's more, there's uncommon things that keep coming out every week about how this is affecting people.
And I think that's maybe one of the hard parts about, like, you know, when we talk about, you know, saying like, oh, high risk, if you're high risk, you should isolate more aggressively, because sometimes it's kind of hard to tell who that high risk category is. And then also, you know, as we talk about expanding bubbles, you know, you may be, if you're, maybe you're not a high risk, but then you have contact with high risk people all the time. So it's really hard to kind of isolate out specific people, like in certain demographics or with certain diseases, because as you open things up, it's just more challenging to do that. But
it does seem like it does seem to have gravitated into nursing homes, though, and those places seem to be the places of the greatest amount of deaths we've seen throughout the states, and it's perplexing to me how it continues to get in there and infect a whole population of people in a nursing home. Mm-hmm. So that's why we have these extra precautions for our local nursing homes.
Yeah, I mean, there was a thing that was released a few weeks back, which talked about kind of there's four primary factors where you have this massive, where you can get spread of the disease. And one is congregate living. So like that was definitely nursing homes, prisons, things like that. You know, another was travel, right? And then some of them was like these massive gatherings. I forget number four, but there was kind of like four things they said. These are things that can really cause significant outbreaks, and that congregate living setting is definitely a big one. And then you look at, you know, nursing homes tend to be older patients with a lot of chronic diseases. So it's not surprising that once it gets in, that it's more deadly, because that population is certainly checks all the boxes for high risk.
Really fragile.
Before I go into Curtis and his new stardom, Steve, you were talking about some transmission information that you had from China, and that sort of goes in with.
Yeah, it was me.
That was you?
Was even.
Yeah. Even.
So there's actually a study done in looking back, a retrospective study in Hubei, China. Looking at 313, what they call, I can't remember how they put it, clusters is what they put it, this is areas where one person infected three or more people, or a group of three people got this disease in seemingly the same place. Out of the 313 cases that they found, only one was outdoors. 312 were indoors. And this points back to the credence that, you know, people kind of rail on the masks and stuff like that and the social distancing. And it's hard to do, I get that. But in concentrated areas, like when you're going to the store and all comers are coming in there, it's probably not a bad idea to throw a mask on for a few minutes to protect others and protect. I believe that you can be protecting yourself a little bit, even though it's not a viral mask. You're going to keep droplets out. But it is indoors. And as we've been encouraging you here in Kodiak, it's awesome that we're able to get outdoors and exercise as much as we want. And there's plenty of spaces to do it. When you get extremely crowded beaches in the lower 48, I get where that's a problem. But even when they close all beaches, I haven't lived there for a while, so it's hard for me to imagine that it's that helpful when you start closing a lot of outdoor areas. But I think being cautious when you have large groups indoors is very important.
So, Dr. Mortensen, you're a video star, as I understand it.
I was going to say, video killed the radio star, right?
So. You had an opportunity to give a presentation last night to the state on about how well Kodiak is doing in preparing. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I had an opportunity to present a kind of about specifically how our clinic has responded to the pandemic, but by and large, how the community has responded to the pandemic. Last night to a group of docs from around the state, I think it was around 200 docs from around the state that were on the call. And, overall, there was just a lot of positive feedback for how Kodiak had responded. Actually, there was, Ann Zink was on the call and actually had sent me a message and said, she had enjoyed being here last week and thought that Kodiak was really a kind of a beacon for, how to best handle the pandemic. And she thought that the community had really responded well. So it was humbling to be asked to talk and I think it went okay. Elsa, you can let me know.
Yeah, it was great. You did a really good job. And it really did shine on, not only what KCHC's doing and all the things they're taking care of, but the community. They showed our offsite testing spot and all the things that, when people got together so quickly after this all happened and said, we had an entire room filled in the basement of Prov there in one of their conference rooms before we got so good at social distancing, full of people who all wanted to come together and figure out how we were going to address this as a community. People got together and did the tent and the city came in and gave us space. I mean, it's been an amazing collaboration. And I do think that federal delegation that came really was impressed with Kodiak's, they looked at our alternative care site and the guy says, well, we sent in the Army Corps of Engineers to help you guys set this up, right? And they're like, no, we did it ourselves in like 3 days. We set this entire thing up and they were really amazed. It was a great show of this community's strengths.
So now that things are opening up a little more, does everything still stay in place? I mean, are you still on a state of high alert or are you on a higher alert status now?
Yesterday, before the governor's new release, we've gone from this red level, super high alert. We haven't quite gone to the yellow where we're on stand down. So we're somewhere maybe in that orange level, but we're ready, but we're kind of backing off being totally on point, giving everybody a chance to maybe go to weekly meetings. There was a weekly Wednesday morning call in with all of the emergency physicians throughout the state that this morning they actually said, hey, we're going to space it out, not do it today because we're ready, but we aren't. We're going to let everybody kind of relax a little bit and catch their breath. So nothing changes. We still have our alternate care site. We still are screening people. The clinics are really doing a great job of working with individuals and their patients, keeping them safe. So we've kind of taken our high alert status down a little bit to let all the care providers maybe take a breath, but we're really still on high alert.
As a provider, it makes me a little bit nervous. It was talked about earlier that we're opening everything up just as we're getting a big influx of people from the lower 48. The timing is somewhat unfortunate, but I got to say, like Curtis had said, we're so much better prepared now than we were a couple of months ago. We're in a much, much better place than we were a couple of months ago. When we first started this radio show, we had about 80 tests for the city of Kodiak, period. That's it. And none of them were rapid tests.
Just testing supplies available. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Testing supplies. We had enough to check 80 people. Now, potentially, we could check 80 people a day if needed. If we really needed to ramp things up, we could come up with it and check 80 people a day. And it'd be hard, but it could be done. And so we're in a far better place than we were 2 months ago.
So I think one of the things that we, before last night's governor's release, was we were looking about, okay, what's it going to look like in a month from now? Do we need to have the screening tent out in front of the hospital? Can we kind of back that off and not use so many personnel all at one time? What's the new normal? I had Chief Milliken over at the emergency room yesterday. We were looking at how do we work to, in 2 or 3 months, what's going to be our process for dealing with patients. So we're starting to look down past the, okay, we have the crisis, how are we going to handle that? And then maybe it's kind of stabilized. What's it going to be like 2 and 3 months from now or a year from now? What's that new normal? So we're at different levels. You know, we're kind of on cruise right now, on standby, waiting for something. I share Evan's concern that it would have been nice to have done this gradual. It just sounds like, okay, go for it, let your guard down, and we're going to see what happens. That's my worry.
Let's talk a little bit about the testing machine. We got a lot of criticism in the last week about the Abbott machine, which we use here. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I guess I can take that one, and you guys can chime in as you want. So there was a study that was done, and I don't have the numbers off the top of my head as far as how many tests were
looked at. It was like 101 or something.
Yeah, and so it was with our Abbott ID Now test, which is the testing that both Canna, KCHC, and the hospital all use for their rapid testing. And what this study found was that there was about a 30% false negative rate. So 30% of the tests that were done that were these were tests that were confirmed to be positive were actually negative on the Abbott test, the rapid test, but were positive on the PCR test, the confirmatory test, which is obviously concerning because we're using this to screen people before they go into the hospital for elective procedures, and this is kind of what we're using at the tent when people come in and they have symptoms. Anyways, that wasn't great news for us, and we were kind of learning a lot about these tests as we go along. However, one thing about the test that's a little bit different is that it was used with on samples that were put in viral media, so they were diluted samples, which we are not doing anymore. We about a month ago, we went from doing the diluted samples to doing what we call dry samples, where basically it goes straight from a person's nasal passage straight into the machine. So it's not exactly dry, I would say. There's maybe some moisture in there. But we aren't diluting the sample, and that keeps the viral load higher, and so then more likely to be detected. So I think that there's a pretty good argument for that the test is actually more sensitive than what is in this study. The state of Alaska, however, has recommendations on this, and they do recommend that we send each sample now to the state for confirmatory testing on a PCR. And we had actually stopped doing that about a week and a half ago because of the mailing all these samples out the weather. And, you know, like there's just lots of like kind of things about it that weren't very efficient. And we thought that the test was at that time was considered to be good enough to do that with. But I think with this new news, we'll probably be starting to send those tests back out to the state for confirmation. So almost like thinking of it again, we sort of initially when we brought the test, we kind of thought of it as like the initial rapid, like a rapid strep test, and then you wait for the confirmatory test to come back. And we kind of went away from that for a little while, but kind of in light of some of this new evidence, we probably ought to start doing that again.
I think that too, in the state of Alaska, because we have gone to that dry swab a while ago, Dr. Gilly at the lab said that of the 350 tests that they had sent in from the Abbotts, they only had one false negative that they found. So that's a pretty good rate. Mm-hmm. A lot of it has to do with the prevalence of disease in an area too. You know, this was done in New York where they had huge numbers. And so that makes a difference too about how many potential false negatives you'll find.
But this is a criticism that we had a month ago. We discussed this a month ago, so it's not anything new, and we talked about it on this show before. This is something that we've corrected with ANMC. They've been watching the numbers of the confirmatory we've been sending to them, and they find the accuracy, if there's 120 virus per milliliter or greater, which is a very, very small viral load. Most people are infected have thousands per milliliter of what you're extracting, if not sometimes in the hundreds and millions per milliliter. If it's even has 120 virons per milliliter, the accuracy is greater than 97% with the Abbott machine, according to the ANMC studies. They have an epidemiologist and an ID doc working on it. So it's still a very accurate test the way we are doing it. When you dilute it down, it becomes much, much less accurate because you still need that 120, you know, the threshold we were using, 120 viral copies per milliliter. Well, now you've diluted it down significantly by putting it into a liquid. And that's why it became less accurate. If you add, I would guess, you must have multiplied the liquid on that swab by six or seven times. Well, now it's basically 1/6 as accurate. As it could be, which could still be fairly accurate even then. But we these numbers don't necessarily apply to what's happening in Kodiak.
Well, I think one thing that I actually had written down is something to maybe describe, and I don't want to get overly academic, but we use these terms sensitivity and specificity a lot. And I've had a lot of questions from people on the street and patients about what that means. So. Sensitivity, I think of there's a mnemonic for this that you learn when you're in medical school, I think, is it's called spin and snout. So specificity rules in spin, okay? So if you have a specific test and it's positive, it's really good at ruling in that you have the disease, okay? And so the Abbott ID now is shown to be very specific. It's very good. If it's positive, it's very, very good. And then there's snout, sensitivity, SN. So sensitive tests are good at ruling out. So it seems like the Abbott test is not as good on the sensitivity side, so ruling out disease, as it is on the yeah. specificity side. And so I just think it's really important. Those two terms, we just throw them around. And I think it's really important that people know like what those mean exactly.
Let's talk a little bit about hydroxychloroquine. Would in any circumstances, would you prescribe this to somebody as a preventative measure in regards to COVID or in regards to any condition they might be trying to prevent or trying to treat?
Well, let me start out with saying that this is a medicine that's prescribed for a lot of other reasons. So like we use it for rheumatoid arthritis. We use it for malarial prevention. There's other uses of this medicine that are FDA approved and are valid. I would also say that the hard part about any medicines right now, any treatments for COVID, is that there are not randomized control trials. And what I mean by that is that a randomized control trial is somebody where you say, hey, these patients have the same illness. They've been controlled, which means that they have, there's not like self-selected, like they're the same ages, they're the same genders, basically. So you take two groups of people that are exactly the same and you give them the same treatment, or you give them different treatments and you see who does better. We're a long ways away from having that. But that's really the only true way to tell if a treatment is effective. So, you know, right now we're working off of hydroxychloroquine had some studies early on that was shown in like animal models to decrease replication. But in the one study or in the studies we have regarding it so far, they're all to do with very sick patients in the hospital. So there's really been no studies on it as far as from a preventative standpoint for preventing people from getting COVID. I personally wouldn't feel comfortable prescribing it for someone for that reason, because the studies we do have show that there's actually adverse effects to it more so than benefits. But, you know, we're going off of kind of limited data. I think that they should still keep doing studies on it to see if there are some ways to do it. But I don't think it's ready for, certainly not, doesn't meet my comfortability for prescribing it at this point.
Yeah, as it stands right now, people who may not even know they have an electrical problem in their heart could be killed with this medication. And it's tough to put massive amounts of people on hydroxychloroquine because of the changes in the electrical pattern in the heart that it causes. I was very hopeful with it early on, read many studies on it. I was excited about it. And as new studies have come out, I would not prescribe it at this point. I don't think it's worth the risk for the benefit you do get.
So with the patients that are on it regularly, though, is it because you don't have an alternative? I mean, is it something you have to be up front with the patient that, look, you know, we're going to put you on this medication, but there's a potential that you're going to have some serious side effects?
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of it is that there are randomized control trials that show that it's very effective with malarial prevention, and it's very effective in rheumatoid arthritis. We don't have that. So I think for COVID, and so it's always a risk benefit discussion. And if you don't know that you have benefit, but you know that you have risk, then it's probably not worthwhile. And I think that this is a conversation that each of us would have with our individual patient about it. You know, our first, you know, in the oath we take is to do no harm first. And so I think that this probably fits pretty nicely in that thing, is that we don't want to do harm just because there's some sort of a major publicity about this.
Yeah.
On top of that, when we are going to be putting somebody on it for rheumatoid arthritis, we will screen them. We're going to do an EKG to make sure their electrical patterns are, you know, in a normal pattern, so they don't fall into this rhythm that tends to be fatal. And so people are being screened before they're put on this medication. If we're to put everybody on hydroxychloroquine to prevent disease prevention, it'd be pretty tough to get EKGs on everybody in town before we prescribe it. And so I just don't think the benefit is worth it at this point.
It seems like every week there's breaking news about advances in vaccine. Are you excited about any of the news that you've heard or you've been reading about?
I think that with the vaccine, I mean, I would love to see it. I'm optimistic that we'll have that. But to do a good vaccine, you, as Curtis said, you need controlled trials. And you can't push science. I mean, I've said this before. There's a process to come up with either a new medication or, in this case, a vaccine that is safe and effective. And it takes time to develop that, to get that out with a group of people to see if it's effective without having adverse side effects. So I don't think that we're going to see anything. You know, people say, well, we're going to see it in 3 or 4 months, but realistically, it's going to maybe be a year just because of the process of developing that.
Doesn't it appear, though, that we've made a lot of, we've taken a lot of shortcuts in regards to medication, in regards to testing machines? Isn't there a push to to avoid the long process, try to get something available to try and curtail this before a year?
I mean, I think that I'm certainly not fully aware of all the processes that go through. I know that they are taking some shortcuts to try and push this through because of the nature of the problem, and there is certainly a urgency to get it done. But with trying to push something through, you shortcut that, you don't necessarily see all the problems with it before you start giving it to patients. And so that's, I am a little concerned about that because usually vaccines are very rigorously tested. They're probably the most rigorously tested medications that we give, and they are a medication, if you're trying to push it through, you're not going to be able to go through all those same processes in place. And so then, again, when we get to the point where we're talking to patients about this, when it becomes available, I think we're going to have to be very honest and open about what we know and what we don't, is that this is a brand new medicine but we're still kind of studying it. And that day will come. I'll be excited when we get it, but I'm not. As far as time course, it feels like there's something new in the news every day, and I'm going to let that play out where it is. So
we keep getting this question, and I'm not sure if the answer's changed any, but the transmission to animals and from animals, specifically household animals, is concerning to a lot of people because of some reports that came out of China and out of New York. Is it something that people have to be concerned about?
I would have a very low level of concern personally, and here's why. Transmission between animals and humans is extremely rare. That's why this is so unusual. This came from some animal transmitted to humans. We've never seen it before. We're not prepared for it on an immune basis. And it's been a little bit hard on people who get this. I will say, though, that there is a tiger who tested positive, and super odd. I don't get it. I'm not sure I believe it, because the transmission between, letting your dog lick your face and then passing it on to others, I think is near zero. It's very negligible. Your cats and your dogs don't spread the same diseases. There are cases where we do have parasites and such, but things get so specific to different species that even different types of lice won't go to your dog. Like human lice doesn't go to your dog, even though it's covered with hair and it seems like it would be a field day. It's a different type of lice that the dog gets infected with. But is it possible out there in the world? Well, we know it's happened because we've gotten the bird flu before. We've gotten this disease wherever the origination was. But the reason why it's big news is because it's super rare.
So the moral of the story is don't let your tiger lick you?
No. don't let your tigers lick you.
Yeah.
The lady out in the flats, right. Yeah. We're past time here, but I would like you to conclude by giving some advice to people in the business community and maybe into the church community about how to proceed. If you had a restaurant, if you had a storefront retail business, how would you proceed going into opening up?
Like I said, I think there's some things that don't go out of style. And I don't mean that by a fashion sense, but they're disease prevention for infectious disease, good hand hygiene, make hand sanitizer available as much as possible in your place of business or in your house of worship. Make masks available, encourage mask use, separate out, do different businesses are going to be different for this. So how to separate people, and whether it's at a store where you have signs that say 6 feet apart, or, whether it's tables being made apart, but that social distancing, great hand hygiene, those things never go out of style. And if you can try and do those things, then I think wherever, getting creative in how to do that in your business, I think that that's going to go a long ways.
The church I attend, the Community Baptist Church, they are opening this Sunday. They're separating out the two services. They're going to make it so only every other row is available, so we spread out as much as possible. I don't know if they're going to encourage people to sing a little quieter this Sunday. I'm not sure. But wearing masks is going to be a must. And I hate the masks. I'm like everyone else. The second I get out of Safeway, the mask comes off. If I'm in the open air, I am not wearing a mask. I don't like them. I get why people hate them. And I get why people are looking at studies saying these don't even prevent virus. They do. They do prevent disease spread. And the biggest testimony to this is up at the hospital right now. Our numbers are extremely low. Why? Because people aren't getting patients aren't getting the colds and the flus as much as they normally would in the winter. And our numbers have been very low because of that.
I think even brings a good point. The result of this is if we change our behavior, we're not going to get the common cold as much. We may not get the flu as often. And so just as a human population, we're going to benefit from not getting the Kodiak crud every time we turn around.
Well, and I would also say, like, just to kind of add to that is, you know, if there are ways that people can work remotely or do things virtually, mm-hmm. you know, I think that from our perspective at the clinic, you know, I think telemedicine is kind of going to be here to stay to a certain degree, probably not to the extent it has been. But the fact is, if you're dealing with, infection prevention, you know, if the patient never has to come to see you, then you kind of cut down on that risk of transmission. They can't transmit it through the Zoom, as far as I am aware. So,
and I know that in our church, people have really been enjoying watching. You know, a lot of the big churches have been doing really super jobs of presenting online, you know, the National Cathedral and the big churches that have, you know, gorgeous music and pipe organs. It's kind of been enjoyable, but you miss that socialization, you know, of people. And so that's the biggest piece is that people need to be together. But it also tends to be kind of a fragile group, you know, a lot of elders, you know, attend churches and things. So it is really important to pay attention to those things. And practices are changing, you know, not using communal wines, not doing different things, you know, those things are going to be around probably for a while. But, you know, if we just keep taking care of each other, but making sure that we're reaching out to those others, because that's really the important pieces too, is that a lot of people, and that's, I think, part of the push besides businesses needing to keep going is that isolation that people feel. You need that human connection. You know, and it's a hard thing to get. So maybe people can have their tea out in their yard 6 feet apart with all their coffee klatch, you know, instead of being in the parish hall kind of thing, and still get that community that they need, that personal touch.
So the final question I have is broadly in regards to the Coast Guard transfer season of people moving from a relatively safe community like this to someplace that, you know, like they're going to Georgia or they're going to the East Coast where there's a lot more infection. And the people that are coming into our community, any advice? That kind of go a lot broader than even Coast Guard people. It's for us who've been cooped up on the island for 2 or 3 months who now, you know, things start to open up a little bit more and we have an opportunity to go someplace. What kind of safety protocol? Is it just common sense? Use the mask, use hand washing, stay away from people when you're traveling?
I still think travel, like Curtis was saying, that's one of the top four pieces that they keep looking at. And almost all the cases we've had recently, even where you've had somebody who was quarantined, tested, and then flew here and was tested again, turning positive. I mean, we're just seeing that travel can be a real risk. And so I think you need to think about weigh your risks and benefits, but think of what you're doing. As far as people coming in, you know, the safest piece, no matter what kind of anything we have, is that 2-week quarantine. That's our best defense against anything. And the more people that we can, you know, apply that to, the better. And I'm hoping the Coast Guard has been really strict in the past, so I'm assuming that they will be again with new transfers, making sure that their people are taken care of, but out of the community for a couple of weeks while they settle in.
I think the Coast Guard has been extremely strict to the point where people in the community are saying, oh, we heard there's cases out of there because this family was not allowed to leave their house for 2 weeks. Coast Guard takes it really seriously. When they tell you that they want you in your house for 2 weeks, you're in your house for 2 weeks. And I actually applaud the Coast Guard, the steps that they've taken and the contributions they've made to make this work together as a community.
It's problematic, though, isn't it, that the cases that are arising in the state are into these remote communities where people have already been tested one or two times before they've test positive?
That's why, you know, I think that it's important to realize both the limitations of the test, because if you're testing an asymptomatic person, they probably don't have as high of a viral load. They're probably more likely to have a falsely negative test, right? Like, rather than like an acutely symptomatic person. And I also think that, you know, the CDC, there's kind of two different approaches to ruling somebody out. There's the symptom based, and then there's just kind of the testing based, and then just the time based. And so I think that, if you're moving or, you know, going, if you can do the 14 day quarantine, that is more effective than if you're doing this testing based criteria. You know, obviously there's certain jobs that require you to, you know, we were actually just talking this morning, Dr. Smith and I were talking this morning, because we have a provider that's going to come up, and hopefully we would like them to cover some call for us, because our providers have been taking more call than usual, but they're coming from out of state. And so how do we, you know, if we have to have them sit on the sideline for 14 days, that's not going to do us a lot of good. So, you know, trying to figure out like how you do those types of things safely, you know, and maybe the right decision is going to be not to have them come. Maybe it's just to kind of, you know, figure out like, what we're going to do with that. But definitely if you can do the 14-day quarantine, that is the safest way to do it. The Coast Guard has done, I think, a real excellent job of doing it. Of course, they have the ability to kind of mandate things like that, whereas, you know, in kind of the civilian community, we don't have that ability probably as much.
So one of the messages that comes out of this to our ESC and stuff is we can't let our guard down. I mean, I still think that even though we just got told, hey, you can go back to business as usual per se, you still, if we don't use these practices, hand hygiene, keeping our distance, wearing our mask when we're out, we're likely going to see an influx of COVID. And it's a good point. These companies that they've been quarantining, they've been testing people, retest them before they go out, and then they test positive, just shows you that if you're testing asymptomatic people, you may miss it, because it's not the greatest test for those asymptomatic persons at this time.
So it's really boils down to what the governor is actually saying. We as a community need to be responsible for what happens here, and each individual has to be responsible for what they do.
Agreed.
Yes.
Nobody's going to look out for you like you.
Yeah.
Keep track of who you talk to.
So yeah. did you actually resolve that question that you had about bringing somebody in? Was that the answer? Was that you decided not to bring them in?
I might have spoken too soon, because we're still in the process of trying to figure it out. But yeah.
So Providence Health System in Alaska has actually a little more restrictive travel thing for employees. And right now, as of a week and a half ago, if you traveled outside of Alaska for non-essential travel, like, you know, if you have to go out for legal reasons or medical care that you can't receive in Alaska, there's an exemption there. But otherwise, as an employee and seeing patients, you have to go through a mandated 14-day quarantine. And that doesn't mean you can put on an N95 mask at this point and see patients, even if it's one of our ER docs, you know, and like it gets critical, or in Curtis's case, bringing somebody in. So we're in the process of clarifying that today, you know, in the next day or so. So it's a moving, fluid situation, and I think everybody's trying to err on the side of being really conservative for patient safety.
I think it goes over into the community at large, though. Not only is it a medical issue, if you're a business owner or you're a fisherman, you know, there's certain protocols that apply to you that for good business practices and keeping the community safe, those are the kind of things that you have to think through. And for the best of the community, I guess, it's to maintain the quarantine for 14 days.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, they've done a really good job here, you know, with, like, the boats that have been coming in and things. They have to submit a plan. They have to show how they are going to provide that 14-day quarantine for those people and, how they're going to manage it. And so that's a really effective piece of this, and I hope that's going to continue. I assume it will.
And, we had the visit last week with Dr. Zink and then the physician who's the main doc for the Department of Homeland Security, and they were very impressed with what the canneries are doing both locally on trying to ensure our community safety, and they're really, I think, almost a good example of what to do. They're quarantining people. They are trying to check them. They've got a plan and process. If somebody shows symptoms, what they're going to do, you know, how they're going to keep them separate. And I think that was one of the things that came out of the visit last Wednesday was, our whole community in Kodiak is probably way ahead of the curve on looking down the road.
And it's part of that is why they did find those positives, because mm-hmm. they were on such high alert and checking people that we were able to find them before it spread in the community.
I think that'll wrap her up for today. What do you think?
All right.
It's going to be an interesting week. We'll see what happens by Friday. Stay tuned to the radio. Check frequently to the state websites and your local websites to find out more information about how this rolls out. And hopefully we'll proceed cautiously and get through this all. And the community will open back up again. And you folks won't be over busy.
Thanks,
Ed. Thank you.
Thank you all.